Oh, sure. At that point, you need a siesta. Do they take siestas in Colombia?
I do.
You count as they, so that's a yes. Welcome to the Maximize This podcast, the only podcast with a gold medal in awesome.
Today we're going to talk about how the attention economy has caused us to think things are horrible in the world, but really it's kind of a distorted view. Things aren't really that bad. This is actually potentially a problem for us as a democracy.
And we haven't talked about death yet on this podcast, so why don't we talk about what it is you want to be known for when you die and how that affects your life?
That sounds like a great idea. Let's talk about death.
But before we talk about that, I want to hear about this crazy, what, you went bungee jumping? What'd you do this? Like, I can't keep up with all this crazy stuff that you do.
Okay, so I got back from the Amazon, right?
Yes.
My roommate and I, who are both have short amount of time left in Colombia, were like, all right, what are we going to do this weekend? Let's go on a trip because they have a lot of holidays here in Colombia. And the following Monday was a holiday again. So, the Perseids happened, supposedly the best shooting star storm in 20 years. Did you go see that?
I did not. I think it was cloudy here. That's my story and I'm sticking to it.
So we were all ready to go to this and we texted our WhatsApp group for the Amazon people. Hey, who wants to go? And some of them are like, no, but we're going to see whales. We can't go. I'm like, whales, wait a minute. So we found out that there were spots left. Actually, we coerced them to make two more spots on the whale watching trip. Took a 12-hour bus across Colombia to the Pacific.
Oh, 12-hour bus.
Yes, overnight.
No, thank you. I'll go on to YouTube and watch some videos of whales.
Oh, it was great. And it was 81 Colombians. Me, another American, and an Estonian in two giant chartered buses and carted around in boats and tractors. It was amazing. Loved it.
Qué bueno.
Qué bueno. And I just want to put a plug for Medellin Bungee, which is the tour company I've been going on these trips with, including the Amazon and Guajira. I love the experience. It's a lot more low-key and personal than a lot of tour companies I've ever gone with.
So 2 months left on your visa. We'll be interested to see what you do with your remaining time there and what you do afterward.
Yeah. I want a non-family update.
You want a non-family update. So I have to talk about something that I'm doing that has no relation to my family whatsoever.
Yes.
Can it be something where my family was present?
If you can describe it without using the words family, toddler, son, parents, mom, stepmom, wife.
I can do that.
Excellent.
I believe we've discussed previously one of the best ways of improving your running performance.
By running more.
No. This is dead simple, right? Forget running more. Forget carb loading. Forget rolling out your muscles. I have a much better way of improving your running. You ready for this?
I'm ready.
The key to improving your race performance is to choose smaller races.
Smaller like fewer people.
Smaller like fewer people.
Really?
Yes. Because when there are fewer people to compete with, your odds of doing well go up. So this past weekend, I ran in a 5K that maybe had 100 people in it.
Did you win?
I won my age group, 30 to 39.
And how many competitors did you have in your age group?
I have no idea. All I know is that I now have a sweet mug that says 5K winner on it.
Congratulations.
Yes. My family was present there. Actually, they all ran it too. Everybody ran.
You said the word family.
Oh, well, I'll cut that.
Oh, no, it's okay. I'm just giving you feedback.
There's virtually nothing I do in my life that does not somehow involve my family.
You and I are so different.
I know. That's why it makes for a good show.
Speaking of show.
Yes.
You know, Trump is like, oh, it's the worst time in history and we have to make the world safe. And then there's an article that you sent to me that's actually, it's very long. It's quite insightful. It sounds kind of blasé. Things aren't that bad, but it goes into a lot of depth about what's actually going on and how this misperception of the state of the world is actually really bad for us.
Yeah, like if you consume any of the normal media that's out there right now, you would think that the world is going to hell in a handbasket. War, crime, poverty, you name it. Everything is bad and getting worse.
I really want to read a quote from the article. Can I do that?
Go for it.
So he goes like this. So wait, just in my lifetime, I've seen 2 foreign invasions and 4 wars, half a dozen Middle Eastern governments toppled, 9/11, 2 stock market crashes, and the worst global recession in the last 85 years, a genocide in Europe, the Berlin Wall falling, the end of the Soviet bloc, and 1 O.J. Simpson car chase. Yet these people think that now, today, is the most chaotic and dangerous time in recent memory. After all that other stuff happened, it kind of puts it in perspective.
It's very rare that you're going to see a lot of good news on newspapers or TV or internet, because those kinds of things are not what typically attract attention. But I mean, if you look at across the world, deaths from malaria, malnutrition, infant mortality, war, like the number of active conflicts going on in the world right now, across all of these different metrics, it's never been a better time to be alive than right now. And I think a lot of that gets lost in the day-to-day information that we're presented with. Right.
The key is looking at data. The data shows that things are getting better, but people's feelings and instinct is now distorted because of how society shares information differently now than in the past.
The best way to get people motivated to share stories is to get them angry or outraged. Things that this or that political candidate said that is just truly outrageous, and I can't believe that they would ever say something like that, or, you know, this scandal or this, you know, corruption. All of these things are things that make people angry, and that's the stuff that gets us incensed and want to share that information.
This resonates to me very strongly with an interview I saw with Newt Gingrich. It was amazing. I think it was with Letterman. He's pushing Gingrich to be data-driven, and Gingrich is like, oh, yeah, I'm data-driven, and things are worse than ever. And Letterman's like, basically lists these statistics you're talking about, and Gingrich is like, oh, that's not the same. You can show me any statistic that you want, but what's actually important is how people feel. And there are data that show people feel and fear that things are worse than ever, and that's the real data. So basically, Gingrich is like, what's important is the people's perception of the fear, which I will grant is important, but policy shouldn't be directed based on the fear or perception of the thing. It should be based on the data. And basically we're saying, like, politicians can now cultivate a fear and then look at that data and say, oh, look, 80% of people are afraid of blah because we cultivated that fear. Now let's go make policy against it. It's just pushing and pushing and making it more fear-based on both sides of the aisle.
For sure. And I saw this interview, and his job is to get people elected, not to make good public policy.
I mean, this is kind of an obvious point. Everyone kind of knows this and will agree. We're spreading our attention so thin, we're losing the all-important life skill of focus, and that's what generates long-term success. So if you can't strategize and think long-term on a project, at school, at work, on relationships. Focusing on long-term is a really important life skill, and now we're all losing that because of this attention span issue.
Yeah, and it's important to be aware that this is a conscious effort on the part of all of these institutions, these media organizations, that, you know, they do very rigorous analytical testing about what kinds of headlines people are more likely to click on. Uh-huh. And they, of course, run the more sensational ones, because at the end of the day, all of these companies are trying to make money. They're trying to sell ad revenue. And all of that dwarfs the importance of delivering unbiased or unsensational information.
This is one of the reasons that I hate markets. This is and optimizing marketing and why I don't think I could ever make myself work for a company that's just trying to increase the number of views or trying to attract more traffic, because you're hyper-optimizing something based on a human behavior that I think is unhealthy for us.
Oh, for sure. You're preying on people's worst aspects. Absolutely.
Right.
I mean, we talked about it, I think, maybe in the first episode about people are more likely to respond and make decisions emotionally. And all of these, you know, outlets are preying upon that tendency of people. Like, that's, it's a very vicious and self-perpetuating cycle that I agree with you. I don't think it's not healthy to stay mired down in the muck of this for long periods of time, which is why it's important to take a step back and look at the big picture of things and realize that there are a lot of things going really well in the world right now. I'm happy to at least entertain the opposite position now, that while things are heading in the right direction, the possibility of a global calamity is higher now than it's been in the past, simply due to the shrinking of the world due to technology. Like, if you look in the, you know, the 1200s, if you have the Black Plague, you know, sweeping through Europe, I mean, yeah, it's devastating and terrible for Europe, but there's no airline, you know, worldwide transportation network that's going to spread that across the planet.
Things are now more integrated and connected. And if now institutions and companies are built on top of that, and so if one thing breaks somewhere, it can cripple things very far away at the same time.
Yep. World War II taught us that we no longer have any buffer at all for a global conflict. A global conflict with modern weapons would destroy the planet. Like, that would be it. So it's in our interest to avoid such a thing. There's lots of possibilities for economic downturns, you know, disease outbreaks. All of these are more likely now than they have been in the past, but I still don't think that they're likely.
And also the funny thing is those points are not talked about in the media. The actual increased threats.
Those are the things I'm worried about personally. I mean, I don't spend a lot of time worrying in general, but if you ask me what the existential threats are to civilization, you know, some freak chain of events causing World War III or a global pandemic or an asteroid impact. Those are the things that I wish we were a little more robust against than we currently are.
Can we go back to this company thing, this like hyper-optimizing ads point?
For sure.
Do you think that all of these jobs that now exist for digital marketing, I mean, do you think that's kind of evil? Do you think that it's something that companies should try not to do because it's perpetuating something that's negative in our lives right now, in our culture?
Companies are attempting to make money. And in an industry, the companies that do the best job making money are the ones that are going to come out on top.
And survive and keep the jobs for all the people working for them. I mean, yeah.
This is not a good thing. Like, please don't ever misunderstand. I don't think that this is a healthy thing at all, but it is a reality of what, you know, mm-hmm. companies do, especially publicly traded companies, which have their fiduciary duty, as it were, to make money for their shareholders.
Can we talk about that another day, the fiduciary duty and the distortion that creates in the markets and all those things?
Absolutely. Didn't you send me something about why? Oh, yeah, about like corporate structure, industrial organization theory, industrial theory?
Yes, exactly. The fact that morals have kind of come out of the picture in society and it's a lot more secular may have led to this distortion now of what fiduciary responsibility really means. And now the leaders are actually changing the game.
For me, step one is recognizing that there's a lot going well in the world right now. It doesn't mean that things are going well everywhere, and it doesn't mean that there aren't problems that we should be actively trying to solve both globally and in our own communities. But in general, the trends on most things are in a good direction. Step two is also recognizing the incentives of these media organizations and what they're trying to get people to do. Step three then becomes, how much of my time am I going to spend exposed to this phenomenon?
So here's the thing. I don't agree with you, because it's just not going to work. Finally, we disagree on something today. You, Todd, in order to improve your life, can do the things that you just said. If you're talking about millions of people that have this wired human behavioral instinct to be drawn towards the things that are extreme, then there is a structural push for any entity or company or politician to leverage it, which could become abuse. So how do you change the structure so that there isn't that human tendency? I don't think you can. Or how do you create some marketing campaign or create some awareness enough so that politicians and companies don't abuse it?
Here's how I think about it. If you look at the material, the information that you're provided with on a day-to-day basis, there's some signal-to-noise ratio, right? Like, there's some information that's coming through that's great, and there's some information that's coming through that's just total noise, right? Like, if I was looking at, you know, poll data back in January of this year about who was going to be the Republican presidential nominee, 90% of the stuff that I was getting was total noise. Whereas if I waited 6 months, I would be able to know what the actual signal was, which was, for better or worse, Donald Trump is now the, you know, Republican presidential nominee. So by just not paying any attention to what's going on during that 6 month period, I avoid all of the noise, all of the craziness that surrounded the debates and who's saying this and that when. Like, you just skip all that and you can get to the point where it's like, okay, now we're at this situation where I know who the candidate is. I don't need to worry about all of the stuff that came before that.
What you're saying is you're deciding when to seek out certain information rather than putting yourself in the middle where you're bombarded with a whole bunch of information that you don't necessarily need or want at the time. It's a pull versus push argument.
Exactly. So when an event happens, there are tons of people trying to make sense of what just happened, for good or for bad. And it's something that over time becomes clear. By limiting your information consumption to long form stories about things that have happened in the past, it's mm-hmm. easier to get a sense of what the true narrative actually was rather than the various inaccurate ones that are presented immediately following an event.
Well, I think what you said is fine on a case by case, but there's 1,000 different things every day that you're subconsciously getting unless you change where you get your information and enforce it.
Yeah. So what it takes is a conscious decision to limit the sources and the amount of information that you receive. Turn off Twitter, turn off Facebook, turn off Reddit, turn off everything that you would normally look at. Just cut it off for, like, even if it's just a day, but ideally more, like a week. And see if you don't just feel a little bit better than you did before when you were reading about all of these things. You'll be surprised how much of the stuff that we see day in and day out just drifts off into irrelevancy so fast. So fast. Things that are the huge story right now, people forget about after 3 months. And if you forget about after 3 months, why did you even care in the first place?
So my solution was going to be something that still let me pay attention to everything. Remember that everything that you're reading is an anecdote. And when I say anecdote, I just mean something that happened once. And keep in mind that it's not data and it's not statistics. So it is not representative of how the whole world is necessarily working. Mm-hmm. It's just that now we have visibility into knowing that, like, for instance, the first female athlete to wear a headscarf has now won a medal in the Olympics.
Well, that's incredible.
So then that's incredible. Now, we all know this is a step forward and we're kind of all aware of this, but also I try to keep it in context and I try to not get over enraged or excited about anything that happens.
Right.
I'm just trying to be more self-conscious and aware of the fact that these things that seem spectacular, similar things are always happening. And there's no reason to react to it. But that means I do read all these things. I just like to know kind of what's happening everywhere.
Oh, for sure. Believe me, this is not I don't want to make it sound like this was an easy thing to do at all. And like, I've backslid a lot. Like, it's really tough when everyone's talking about this or that thing that just happened. And you're like, I don't know what it is you're talking about. So I'm not saying cut it off completely, but I would say at least start from there and then slowly let back in the sources that are, you know, reputable and informative.
That was also this author's conclusion, that he's just trying to read sources that are well-researched, you know, real journalism the way we had in the past, and use only that to get his actual information,
mm-hmm.
which if you can, I agree, is a good way to do it. Okay, I have a few takeaways.
Okay.
Don't buy into every story. Don't give it so much importance. Number two, learning to recognize the difference between an anecdote and a statistic. And then the third, anytime you even see a statistic, you got to question how they're formed. Just because a study exists doesn't mean that the person who did the study did it correctly. And it could be that the person doing the study is biased. And it could be that they're asking the wrong question and that the true cause of something is not shown in that data. So questioning statistics is very important in making sure that we don't get sucked in to this sensationalism of attention economy.
Hmm.
I think the other key is to recognize that it's a problem. And that's something we learn a lot in consulting and in our jobs, is convincing someone is a problem is the biggest challenge in creating a change. So now it's not just about like emailing killing our productivity at work or like people wasting time on Pokemon. Now it's creeping into our political system and how people leverage our overuse of digital stuff and our attention spans. There could be irreparable damage to our democracy if we're not careful.
Are you saying me hitting level 16 in Pokemon Go is not important? I don't know what you're... I don't believe you.
When I was 18,
yes,
there was only one thing that I wanted in life.
Okay.
I wanted to have a constant in physics named after me. I wanted there to be a Pollock's constant.
Hmm.
That's all I wanted in life.
How's that working out for you?
I stopped doing physics about 20 years ago, 15 years ago.
Oh,
you can't. Not so good, not so good. But yeah, I don't know. I guess I wanted to be known as a smart person who did a lot of groundbreaking stuff in physics. And that's kind of what I wanted to be known for when I died. So basically, what we're talking about is, what is it that you want to be known for when you die? And not just that, but how do you prevent ego from getting in the way?
Let me guess your answer and say that it likely has something to do with some world-changing impact to people, improving their life situations, like having a global impact on people's lives that raises everyone up.
So that's an excellent guess. That is what most people probably think my answer is.
But am I wrong?
You are.
Really?
Well, there's two reasons. I used to feel that way. I used to have that drive. And I still get really excited when I'm around other people that have that. And I want to do that with them. But for me, I think it's also still more ego-driven. Like, I want to be the person that makes this big, significant change. In reality, you're going to have a small impact in some small piece as, you know, the institutions that rule the world or take thousands and thousands of people and thousands of leaders, millions of people, to operate. So being that person that creates this global change usually doesn't really even happen. It's not even a realistic goal.
Hmm.
When it comes to, you can have impact day to day with a lot of people and helping in a small way, but then that goal becomes different. It becomes impacting people personally that you deal with day to day.
I see what you're saying, that, like, you know, just looking at it from a raw numbers game, the chance that any one given person is going to have, you know, a global mega impact is low. And if you set that as your goal, you're likely to be disappointed. But maybe that's not the right way
to frame it.
Maybe, like, numerically, it's not the right way to sort of phrase how one should pick the things that one wants to do.
You're talking about goals. You're talking about aiming high and trying to achieve something. That's different from on your deathbed, how do you want people to remember you? So for instance, if my goal were to change the world for better and try to help developing countries and something, 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 mm-hmm. then if you decompose that into what's driving me, it could be that my ego drives me to want to have a lot of control and power in places where I can help people and wants to have fame and credit for it. Or it could be that I'm driven to help people in less than satisfactory situations and that I've sacrificed XYZ comfort levels and taken risks in order to do so. Mm-hmm. In which case, how I want people to see me is a person who sacrifices comfort, personal comfort, in order to help other people and is willing to take risks.
Okay.
That might be one of my answers, actually.
Let's play Would You Rather.
Would you rather? All right.
Would you rather have this global impact that you're talking about, you know, improving the lives of citizens around the world, but not have anyone know about it, only you would know that you made this impact? Or
yes, that's on my list of things.
People think that you did this amazing thing, like you set up this charity, this foundation that collects a lot of money, and everyone thinks that it cured malaria or, you know, whatever. Everyone thinks that it did some great thing for all these people, but it didn't actually do anything.
Definitely the first one.
Okay.
Absolutely the first
one. Okay, so that's your answer, right? Like, I mean, clearly making the impact is more important, and I think most people would give the answer you gave. But I think that's sort of what it speaks to. It's like, we're looking to make the improvement. We're not interested in what other people think we did, what other people remember us for. I mean, it's interesting to me, the sort of juxtaposition of these two questions. What is it you want to be known for when you die? And how do you prevent ego from getting in the way? Like, how you want to be remembered is a purely ego-driven thing.
Let's forget the possibility that I tricked the world into seeing me in a way that's not me. Mm-hmm. It probably means I did a lot of good things for a lot of people, and that's what stood out. It's not ego. It's like, what parts of you are actually going to stand out in such a way that the people who know you know that as the key thing. So for instance, I do not want to be known as a perfectionist who made bad life decisions because of being a perfectionist. I don't want to be the person who quit her job and traveled all around South America and didn't do anything. And I always kind of have that fear that this is going to be the end result. And when I explain it to my friends, they're like, shut up, you've done a lot, it's fine. But I have the insecurity, I have the fear that that's not going to be how people see me. Maybe, again, that's ego. So this is the thing, right? If you're afraid that people will perceive you a certain way, and that prevents you from making a decision, then that's wrong.
I absolutely agree that letting other people's perceptions of your behavior drive your choices is a terrible, terrible idea.
It's a terrible idea.
It's a terrible.
Exactly.
Nope. Happiness does not lie down that path.
And it's because, I mean, you're going to end up doing things for reasons that are not maximizing your own happiness or success or priorities.
Right.
And the only way to avoid that, the only way to avoid having other people's perceptions drive you is to be really clear on what you actually want to go towards. And again, what you want to be known for when you die is one way of framing that question.
Yeah. Not taking it to the full extreme of writing your own obituary, like, yeah, having that sort of end goal in mind is a good idea.
And I think my example in high school about wanting to have that physics constant, I mean, I think it's because back then my identity was the smarty pants thing. Like, I was a perfectionist and I had so many insecurities that I could only handle, like my identity was that I did well in school and I felt like as long as I had that, then I would be okay and I would be accepted because there's some admiration or respect for the person, for the people that do well in school. And so if I had a constant in physics named after me, that would kind of solidify that.
Right. It would be like validation that, yes, she was smart. Look, there's this physics thing named after her.
Exactly. So now, actually, at the ripe old age of 36, I have a different answer. So there's another thing that I want to be known for now, but I want you to go first.
Okay. So you're asking, what do I want to be known for when I die?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, top of the list is good husband and good father. Like, that's a clear answer for me. And I don't really see that changing. I enjoy having an impact in my community. You know, I work as the block captain for my, you know, neighborhood group. I'm involved with the parent advisory board for one of the early childhood programs in the city. So having that kind of impact is important to me. And, you know, I like running. It'd be nice to get faster.
Do you want to be known as a runner?
Yeah, I want to be known as a runner. And putting out this podcast is fun. These kinds of things, you know.
But that's not the question.
So your question is, what I want people to remember me by?
What do you want to be known for? Known as?
A husband and a father.
That's it, right?
It stops with those two words. And I know that's not the answer. Yeah. That's not the answer for everyone, but it is. Those are the first two words.
Which one first?
The husband first. I can't be a good father without being a good husband, because then I can't set a good relationship model for my son, which is an incredibly important thing for him to learn.
That's true. Why are you such a perfect person? So the reason I first asked this question, it was born, and I'll give you my answer now. It was born of a discussion I had from a really good friend that I just made. And I was lucky or serendipitous to be asked to present to a class of master's students of international business. All right. So I made a presentation, had fun with it. I really liked teaching just from that one session, I found out. And I clicked with the professor who was actually in charge of the class. So I then interacted with him one more time through the school because he wanted a few judges for a startup competition. So I did that. And then we just started grabbing coffee, and turns out he's a really interesting person. He worked in the highest levels of Microsoft way back in the day as a product manager. He's worked as a venture capitalist in Silicon Valley, and now, you know, he's also traveling, an interesting kind of life. And so he and I were talking about life the other day. We were getting a birthday drink, and I was talking about how I felt pressure to go back to the real world, to kind of leave this traveling mode, go back to the US, and then get sucked back into the stuff that I was running away from. A real job with a high title, or maybe get a PhD in economics and all this. And he's like, why do you need a title to define you? And I was like, well, I mean, I've been here all this time to get away from that ego-driven need and to just try to find my own inner drive, right? So then I just asked him, like, well, what defines you? I mean, you have similar struggles. You're talking about choices you have to make. So what defines you? And he just said that when he dies, this is where my question came from to you. He says that when he dies, he just wants to be known as somebody who loves. And that's my answer. As soon as he said that, I realized that's all I wanted to. Because, so when I was a kid, my parents used to teach me to love yourself and love your neighbor and all that good stuff. And I blindly followed that and believed it and like wholeheartedly adopted it. And then like you grow up, you hit puberty, you have social pressure and you start to care what people think of you. In my first job, I was told that I was naive and trusted people too much and that others would take advantage of me and that I had to protect myself. I got a lot of advice for how to professionalize myself, but then I kind of lost this innocent focus. And now I'm trying to get back to it and just kind of eschew everything else. So my actual answer to the question, and I think I know it, and I think this is going to be true for the rest of my life, is just to be a person who loves. Which means loving myself, loving other people, giving them benefit of the doubt. Helping them in a way that's more about them than about my preservation of my relationship with them or my personal interests, and loving things that I do and trying to go after them.
Sounds like a Beatles song. All you need is love.
Thanks. It's very deep.
I mean, it's elegant in its simplicity, right? Like, I mean, you're trying to make sure that your interactions, you know, your interpersonal reactions with people are wholesome and healthy, and that you're, you know, supportive of the people in your life, your friends and family. And there's a tremendous amount of impact and value and worth that can come from that. So it's a fine choice.
I mean, it's kind of vulnerable to say it out loud. It's easier to say in Spanish because you know how language affects how you think. There's a lot of studies on this, and in Spanish we spend a lot of time talking about how we are and how our families are and how we feel and who are your brothers and sisters and all this. It's just a lot more focused, in my view, on relationships. And so saying things like God bless you and love are a lot more common, more easy.
In Spanish.
Yeah. Goes back to my whole view of how Westerners are too isolated and individually focused and work too hard. All those things, which we'll talk about more.
Yeah.
In summary, always gut check yourself and try to do things that nobody else would do, in part because, I don't know, you think they may judge you.
Yeah.
But they sound different and interesting. And they may not appeal to you at first because there's no ego pull or, like, no one will recognize it. But sometimes it's actually what you want to do more than you don't.
Yeah. I think people spend way less time thinking about you and what you do than you spend thinking about what other people think about you. And
that's Completely true.
So
that's completely true.
Focus on you and what you want to accomplish, and let other people worry about themselves.
Remember, it's not all about you. It's not. And it's all about love. All you need is love.
Do, 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 do.
All you need is love.
No singing. Speaking of people with enormous egos.
So tell me really quickly, what's happened in the last 2 weeks since I've been in the jungle?
Okay, so you've been like on media blackout. You're not aware of the fact that Trump has dropped out of the race and has been replaced by an aardvark.
Right.
With a very compelling domestic policy.
Excellent. I'm excited.
No, what's going on?
Is Clinton up now in the polls?
Everything I see right now shows a big hill to climb for Donald Trump.
Hmm.
I don't remember what Nate Silver says if we're looking at him, but I think it was something in the 85% range. Oof. For Secretary Clinton.
What are your odds right now?
What are my odds? I'm sticking with my 2-to-1.
Man.
Just because there's always something that can come up. But at the state level races, all of the swing states are, you know, very favorably lining up for Secretary Clinton to do well in November. She's pulled out of Colorado. She's pulled out of a couple other states where she feels like she's doing so well that she just doesn't even need to have an ad presence there.
That may end up being her strategic mistake that loses her election. Or it may end up being a smart thing.
It's possible.
I'm going to be right, because either one or the other is true. Did you want to talk about protest vote?
I did. So an article crossed my desk. There are people who are not thrilled with either candidate in this election.
There are people who are not thrilled with either candidate.
There are people who are not thrilled 80, with either candidate.
80% of America doesn't really like anybody
right.
in this election.
And
yes.
So the article was discussing registering a protest vote, like voting for a third party, voting for a write-in, not voting as a way of, you know, registering your protest. And the article was making the case that in the system that we currently have, essentially any vote for someone other than the two candidates is a non-factor in the election. You're basically saying, I give up my right to have a say in what happens, and I will let everyone else decide.
Right.
Because of the way the Electoral College is set up, unless you win an entire state, your candidate gets no votes, and there's no third-party candidate that comes close to getting enough votes to win any of the states anywhere.
Right. And when I was first reading this article that you sent across my desk then as well, at first I thought, yeah, it's kind of an obvious point. I mean, we all know that the third party candidate pretty much never wins, never has won, and it's kind of a wasted vote. So usually people end up in the U.S. voting for the lesser of two evils.
Mm-hmm.
I actually disagree. Like, the point of the article is that if you quote unquote protest vote, you're not having an impact.
Right.
Because the third party candidate won't get elected, and because it won't actually, that basically won't make a difference in this election.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't agree, because, so there's two different things. There's two different things happening. One is, will your vote, your protest vote of neither A nor B, will it have an impact in the result of this election? No. But the second thing is, will it communicate a message? Will it serve as an effective signal to the public, to the politicians, to the world, that you disapprove of these choices?
Let's say 10% of Republicans defect and vote for Gary Johnson in this election, thus clearly signaling to the Republican Party that, hey, the guy you ran this time was a clown, and we want someone who's more conservative or more fiscally restrained or whatever. Like, you're communicating to the party that this is what we actually want, in the hopes that the next time the election comes around, that more candidates that fit that personality run.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of it. Yeah. So the protest vote can be meaningful if it has a long-term impact. And kind of there's two ways I see how it could have a long-term impact. One is by signaling to the parties, this is what is important to a lot of the public and you're missing it, so that the party platforms slowly change over time. I do think that does happen. I mean,
I think it's dubious whether the parties actually listen to these votes. Because, I mean, if you look at the numbers of people who vote for Green or Libertarian or any of the other third parties, it's in such a small number that why are the parties wasting their time trying to collect these numbers of votes? And you might say, but if more people did it, then would they pay more attention?
Let's say after Clinton wins, at a big picture with the political system and the laws that are passed by the legislature in the next 8 years,
mm-hmm.
are more likely to reflect some libertarian values if 10% of people vote libertarian versus 5. That's what I think. There's not a direct A then B mechanism for it, so I can't prove it. In order to maintain legitimacy, in order for the government to keep some level of legitimacy and not alienate all of its voters, there is some influence indirectly.
If a candidate or a party wins an election without these third party people, like again, like let's say 10% of the Republicans defect to Gary Johnson in this election, why would the Clinton and the Democrats move toward that direction? Like, they already have a big enough, they already have a big enough tent to win a national election. Like, they don't need to worry about what these people think.
Well, they do, because the next time, if they keep drifting away from this 10%, that 10%, and the 10% has been trending up 5, 6, 7, 8% over time, they're going to lose more to the 10% and risk losing the next election. I'm saying it's not purposeless. I think it's better to vote for somebody and signal here are the kinds of policies that 10% of Americans want versus those 10% not voting at all. And now you have, oh, a lot of people are apathetic. You're not getting a clear policy signal to them and then making it clear what kinds of things that they would need to do to include those 10%.
This is contingent upon the parties actually paying attention to what these people do. I mean, like, if you look at the 2008 and I think even the 2012 election, the Republican National Committees, you know, wrote postmortems on both of those elections, listing out all of the things that the Republican Party needs to do to have a better chance to compete. And there's all the things about, like, being more, you know, accepting of the LGBT community, you know, trying to patch up the relationship with minority voters, backing off on some of the divisive social issues, et cetera, et cetera. Like, a long list of things. I'll put it in the show notes. And look at what all the candidates offer this past year. They basically ignore all of it.
I know.
So they, like, it's just questionable whether anyone even pays attention to what...
Look.
Go ahead.
They know it's there. It's macro. It's macro. It's 20 years, 30 years trend is what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Look, if I'm leading a country, you know, that may happen one day. And I'm going to look out there at my constituency and be like, well, there's 10% of the people who are saying they really want no government and no regulation. And I know that if I completely turn my back on them, that number may grow. And the ability for my government to represent my people is going to drift further and further away. A good leader would keep this in mind and would want to know that information.
A good leader would do those things.
And some presidents, some politicians are good leaders. Therefore, it makes a difference to some extent. I just don't know how much. That is bulletproof argument.
I'll come down and say I agree with the basic premise of the article that in the two-party system, registering a protest vote is basically meaningless.
And I will disagree with you. I will disagree.
And that is your right and privilege. What I would say is that I don't think that the two-party system we have is great. I think efforts should be made to revise and affect that. And that's something that happens. That's a grassroots change that has to happen at the local level.
The point number two, really quick, is that can the third party win? Can the protest vote actually over time create enough momentum to the point so that third party actually does rise to power and win? And it has never happened in the US, but it can happen. Why? It just happened in Argentina. There was a huge revolt against the two main parties, and out of nowhere, Mauricio Macri, who's now the president, he cobbled up a party and was the third party candidate in this election. And he ended up beating the second main party in the first election, causing a runoff. So out of nowhere, they thought there was this third party guy who just created a new party, whatever, whatever. He actually made second place in the election. And he was close enough so that by Argentina rules, they had to have a runoff. In the runoff, he beat the first guy. He beat the incumbent. If people believed that the protest vote mattered, I think it could have a difference.
Sadly, in our system, if we had a split vote, the House of Representatives gets to pick the president. And I don't really want that to happen. You will not find me supporting third-party candidates for this election.
Let's do a runoff system. That would be even better. We don't have to do a ranked choice because that could be confusing to people.
If we're trusting in the electorate to make policy decisions about how to guide our country and they can't figure out how to write 1 through 3 on a ballot, then what's the point of having a democracy in the first place?
Look, like, it took 5 minutes for someone to explain it to me the first time when I was in university. It's not simple. Should I rank all three or not? Like, what does it mean if I do 1 and 2? Or, I mean, it's not completely straightforward.
If I go to a person and say, like,
don't assume it's obvious.
I want you to rank these ice cream flavors in your preference order. And you go, okay, I like this one, and then this one, and then this one. It's not hard.
Trust me, people will get it wrong.
I'm not saying people won't get it wrong, but I think we have to have faith in the electorate that this is something we can handle. They do in other countries, it's no problem.
This is the US you're talking about.
Well, we'll figure out how to get everyone to do ranked choice voting on another episode of Maximize This.
Yes, we will.
So thanks for listening to this episode of the Maximize This podcast. We'll have a discussion page on Reddit at reddit.com/r/maximizethis. We're always interested to hear your perspective. Chime in with your thoughts on the show. And if you have any ideas for future topics.
And check out our website at www.maximizethis.fm. We'll post news, bonus features, show notes.
Yeah, absolutely. And tell your friends and leave a rating on iTunes. Those reviews and ratings are really what help us in the standings and attract new listeners to the show. So it's a big help.
And until next time, don't let pretty good be the enemy of perfect.
Are you still there?
Todd, I lost you.
Oh, dear God, please don't disconnect now. Are you trolling me?
I lost you, but I think we're good.
No, you're actually gone. This is bad. We didn't sync yet.